Hello, podcast fans. Thanks for joining me again on The Wine Road. Today, we're heading down to San Francisco's Bay Area to an urban winery to learn about natural wines. Let's hit the road. This year's Wine Expo in Sonoma County featured a seminar on PetNat, or Petillat Naturel, an ancient method of making a sparkling wine with a single fermentation. It predates the popular method champenois that is used in champagne and sparkling wine houses here in the States and elsewhere. So in a sense, it's a new growing trend that's centuries old. On the panel of PetNat was natural wine producer Jared Brandt of Donkey and Goat Winery in Berkeley. Aside from just letting the wine do its thing, he rarely filters it and adds as little sulfur as possible. There's been a natural wine movement in recent years, but Jared and his wife Tracy have been at it for over two decades.
Yeah, we trained with a natural winemaker in 2002 in France named Eric Texier, and we have always focused on that style. We came back from France in 2003. Very typically here you added a lot of additives to wine, and we just didn't know how, so we never bothered to.
Out of ignorance, for the lack of a better word, then you just didn't do it right.
Even to the extent of I like to experiment every year. And so in 2005, we did an experiment with inoculating with commercial yeast. And I didn't know the whole protocol. So I got a stuck fermentation with my commercial yeast, and I had no problems with all my native yeasts, since the commercial yeasts often need nutrients added, and I didn't add any nutrients.
Well, I was going to ask about that later on, but I've heard that even with native yeast, sometimes it gets stalled and you have to do something to kind of kickstart it again. But you don't have any problem with that, huh?
We have slow fermentations. So since you're sitting here in our office, you can see we don't heat our cellar room, but I've moved, one of these barrels is empty, but seven barrels in here to stay a little bit warmer since we do heat this room, because they're a little bit slow in their fermentation. We found that as long as you adjust to the vineyard's needs, you can get fermentations to go dry with native yeast without any issues. An example of this would be we make a wine called Stone Crusher. It's a Roussanne, which we make on the skins. But one of the reasons we make it on the skins is I was probably over 10 years ago now, but I was in Sweden at a wine tasting, and a friend of mine was there who's a winemaker in Italy named Sasha Radicon. And I was describing this vineyard that every year it would eventually go dry, but it would often take up like a year to go dry. It was the slowest fermentation ever, and I didn't know what to do, and it's very nutrient deficient soil there. And he's like, oh, just leave it on the skins, it'll go dry in like a week. And he turned out to be right. If you leave it on the skins and the skins provide a lot of the nutrients, it goes dry usually not in a week, but within 10, 15 days.
And what exactly are you talking about when you say it goes dry?
Chemically, glucose and fructose approach zero. So I guess the United States government defines dry as less than 20 grams per liter or 2% sugar left over. Because we're trying to use very little sulfur, our definition of dry is 5 grams or less. So no residual sugar and nothing for other bacteria to eat.
Getting back to France, I was surprised in doing some research that this natural wine style began as long ago as the 40s and picked up again in the early 80s.
Yeah, I think, it depends how you look at it. I think probably there was, I'm probably not going to pronounce his name right, but Chavez was a very big proponent of the natural wine style. And then I think actually, ironically, there was a style here that just disappeared. I met the grandparent of a well-known Sonoma winemaker many years ago, and he was talking about when he made wine, even in the 60s, that they didn't add anything to it. He made Grenache and Dry Creek Valley, and he said, like, we didn't use sulfur back then, and they didn't have any additives. So I think, it's a very old style. The Gang of Four and Beaujolais really pushed it. But then it also kind of petered out a little bit, and I think the Italians don't probably get nearly as much credit as they deserve for the style. And now I think it's become maybe a little convoluted because it's become so popular that there's lots of people who are not interested in the style but are simply interested in selling wine who are labeling their wine as natural.
Mm. Why don't you explain what the purpose is for adding sulfur?
So I think there's kind of maybe three or four points that you add sulfur in winemaking. The first point you add sulfur, the first two points is to make sure that you control the yeast and the bacteria within the wine. So very typically in California, when you harvest grapes, you bring them in, you process them, and you add sulfur. We don't do it at that stage, but it makes sense in that stage, possibly if you're going to use commercial yeast, because it would knock out all the native yeast. After you go through, and you do that right after primary fermentation, before you inoculate again for malolactic fermentation, we don't do either. Lots of people, once it's done after malolactic fermentation, add sulfur again to control bacteria, to lower the risk of volatile acidity, for example. Acetobacteria is fairly, doesn't do well with sulfur in the wine. And then again at bottling for a preservative for both, and that has two purposes of bottling. One is antioxidant, so when you're bottling, it's very hard not to expose the wine to a little bit of air. We use a very high-end bottling truck, but we still have a little bit of oxygen ingress. And then also as a preservative to help with shelf life. Where we found it's probably most important is we sell a fair amount of wine in Northern Europe and in Europe in general. And in shipping, sulfur seems to have, we don't have very much sulfur in our wines, period, but it does seem to have a very beneficial impact if you have large temperature swings during shipping. Mm. So we use refrigerated containers. Our importers use refrigerated containers, but inevitably, I always assume it's the port in Hamburg or somewhere, it gets hot. And with no sulfur in the wines, they almost always end up being ruined.
So when wineries do it, in all those cases, they're doing it for the consumer's benefit, ultimately. It's just that's the way they choose to do it.
I would say they're doing it first and foremost for the CFO's benefit, because it lowers your risk in the wine. But I do think they're doing it for the consumer as well.
Right. Since you do make natural wines, it's important to you to source from vineyards that have a very natural approach to their farming practices.
Yes. So we work with vineyards like Filigreen Farms in Anderson Valley, which is... It's actually a twofold interesting one vineyard for us. It's the land is owned by a biodynamic land trust, and it's farmed biodynamically. But even within people who are either organic or biodynamic, we look for really specific farming practices, and we typically buy by the acre so we can help dictate them. Within biodynamics, there's a lot of people who use a product, a chemical called copper sulfate, and that's not something... Well, even though it's considered organic, it's not something that we like to have used. And so Filigreen Farms doesn't use any sulfur in the vineyard, which works really well for us.
A lot of people wonder about sulfur in wine. Why it's there? What's its purpose? Is it giving me headaches? Well, I hope that segment helped answer some questions. And it's probably not sulfur that may be giving you a headache. It's more likely the histamines. But that's a topic for another day. As a proponent of natural wines and an inquisitive experimenter, he has an arsenal of fermentation vessels. He uses wood in various sizes, including large format, concrete, and stainless steel for his sparkling wine.
And we've added this year, which is not up on our website, terracotta is one of our fermentation vessels.
Going back to the original amphora kind of...
Yeah, exactly. We really like... concrete's gained a lot in popularity. I'm totally in love with concrete because you can't sterilize it with steam, and that's what we use to sterilize vessels. We don't want to use any chemicals, and as a result, I always worry that the previous wine is going to have an imprint of the next wine we ferment in there. We really enjoy wood. We use a lot of wood fermentation vessels, and then we do use concrete and terracotta. I do think the larger formats, they're gaining popularity again. You know, Robert Mondavi, when he built his winery originally in the 76, roughly, he had all fancy stainless steel tanks. And in the late 80s or early 90s, he switched back to wood. Wood has some really nice properties for fermentation. It breathes a little, so it rounds out your acids. Also, it insulates. Unlike stainless steel, it provides some natural insulation. So it'll take you a little longer to gain temperature, and then it'll hold temperature a little nicer. Mm. And it's a really nice product to work with. It's when it's empty, it's very hard to maintain, which is, I think, part of the reason it fell out of popularity.
What are you finding that you notice that's different about the terracotta? What do you like about that?
So it's a new experiment for us. We were hoping to have two vessels this year. Sadly, one broke.
That is one problem with that, isn't it?
Theoretically, you can steam them. One we steamed with no problem. The second one we steamed and it split in half. We have a new one being made right now in Florence, Italy for us. The terracotta is really, really interesting texturally is what I'm finding more than anything else. That the wines have a little bit more body and almost like a lot of commercial wineries will add, or more commercial wineries will add gum arabic to give their wines a kind of a thicker texture. It's very typical, actually. It's an additive. And I think the terracotta is kind of providing that in its own natural way.
Isn't it interesting with all the advancements in winemaking, and in many ways we're going back to traditional methods?
Yeah, I love old textbooks. And I have a winemaking textbook from like the late 1800s. And our winemaking process and what's listed in the textbook are almost identical. Wow. I mean, it's not... And I'm a fan of technology. I find it for the wine. It doesn't necessarily add what I'm looking for.
And I've also heard that it's not unusual for you to rely on the traditional foot stomping when you need a little bit more juice.
Yes, we have a very gentle destemmer, and when we need more juice, and actually sometimes before we put wine in the press, we'll foot stomp it as well. The foot is a great has a great ability to break up berries without breaking seeds, which is actually pretty difficult to do perfectly on a mechanical destemmer and crusher. So we love feet, and we have people who end up loving to jump up and down on grapes for an hour or two.
Sure. Your wines are unfined and unfiltered, too, and that can lead to a cloudy wine. Talking about modern technology and methods, you know, sommeliers are taught to look for clarity in wine. But it doesn't bother me to see a cloudy wine. Like, I'm a big fan of natural apple juice, which is always a thicker, cloudy juice. So why not for wine?
So for us, we don't actually always make unfined or unfiltered wines. Occasionally we'll have a wine that has some technical problem with it that we believe that filtering is the right solution for. But we think the wine should be as specific to the place they're from as possible. And finding, which is mainly what you do for clarity, you'll add something like a fish bladder that's been dried and ground up, or bentonite, which is the same product that kitty litter is made from. But in either case, while they're removing the particles that are making it cloudy, I also think they remove a little bit of the flavors. And I'm just not as interested in them. As we've gotten better as winemakers, we've learned we don't do a lot of racking. Like, we'll mainly only rack, so only take the wine out of barrel when we bottle. But we've gotten a lot more careful about it, which you can get a little bit more clarity just by doing that. We never say that we try to make crystal clear wines, and particularly like our sparkling wines, we disgorge by hand, and we just don't care that there's some leftover lees in them. I have a funny story, which I'll tell you. Yeah. Many years ago, I walked into this restaurant in New York to meet the wine buyer, and they had Isabel's Cuvée, which is our rosé. It's named for my 12-year-old. And I walked up to the bar, and the bartender was helping someone else, and she said she was pouring them a glass of Isabel's Cuvée. But she got to the bottom, and there was a legitimate amount of sediment in the bottom. And she said, she looked at the gentleman and said, "You know, I can shake this up and pour it for you. It's all the probiotics, but I have to charge you an extra $2. And I was just in shock, but I didn't say anything. And the guy looked at her, and he's like, "Okay." And she shook up the sediment and poured it in, which I don't recommend doing. But it's funny, the perceptions of what the lees are and tartaric crystals that form in the bottles.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. And it shows that it's more of a handmade, handcrafted wine, which to me, it's like, hey, I'm fine with that.
The comparison I like to make is to Hefeweizen. Hefeweizen's never clear by design. And like, I don't think wine has to be clear.
As you may or may not know, the lees is the sediment that settles on the bottom of the barrel or the vessel as the wine sits. Many winemakers stir up the lees in wine as it ages to round out the mouthfeel, soften, and add a creaminess to it. In natural wines, you'll often see some of the lees or sediment at the bottom or floating in the bottle. Moments ago, he referenced his sparkling wine. That's the Petnat. It's also referred to as Méthode Ancestrale. It's a method of making sparkling wine that predates the champagne method, and as we were just discussing, it has more of a handcrafted appearance to it, rather than a clean, bubbly champagne. The first I tasted was recently at the Wine Expo that was made by Jared at Donkey and Goat Winery. He explains the method.
So the idea of the method is traditional champagne is made by you go dry in barrel, you maybe barrel age for a couple of years, and then you put the wine back in bottle, and at that stage you add yeast and sugar to give you a secondary fermentation that gives you the bubbles. Our Pet Nat, we just use the primary fermentation. So why it's fermenting, when it's about 80% done, it's usually we look for about 25 grams residual sugar per liter. We bottle it while it's fermenting, and then we disgorge it by hand, which is not very precise, so you get sediment in the bottle. Gives you a little bit of a lighter sparkle, and every bottle is different because it's just the natural fermentation providing the sparkles, but we love it. At this stage, we can claim we're the oldest Pet Nat Maker in America, which I think is true. We started experimenting 2009, and we released our first one after the 2011 vintage. But we fine-tuned it. I mean, the downside of Pet Nats is they can be... Every bottle is different, and you know, the you're going to get some great bottles, and as a result, you're also going to get some unusual bottles.
So if you buy a case, it could run the gamut, huh?
Yeah, and in a literal standpoint, we stack our cases while they're fermenting in bottles, seven cases high, and inevitably when we disgorge it, the cases at the top, which is where it stays warmer, are drier than the cases at the bottom. So I always joke, if you want a really brute style, very dry style Pet Nat from us, just leave our bottle out in the sun or leave it on your stove for a couple of days so it gets up to like 85 degrees. And then if there is any residual sugar, it'll go dry and you'll get the style that you're looking for.
You don't get that suggestion from winemakers very often.
No. I mean most wine is meant is just meant already to be done. But I always think of our wines as living products, and then you can play with living products as a result.
Yeah, that's true.
Now tell me about the name, Donkey and Goat. I didn't see that anywhere on your website.
No. My wife and I tell different stories, though they're interrelated. When we moved in 2001, we decided we were done with technology for a year. It was actually only supposed to be a year-long sabbatical. And so I found an internship in France with a winemaker named Eric Texier. And we rented a house, like a half mile down the road from where he lives. And his office is in his house, and he has a cellar there as well. And when we moved from Pacific Heights in San Francisco, we would walk by or sometimes drive by his neighbor's place. And in the morning and the evening, we would see a donkey and a goat together. But during the day, it was always the goat. And I kind of became obsessed with looking. And I noticed it was day in, day out, that would have this pattern. You know, morning, evening, the two animals were together. Daytime, it was just the goat doing something. So I met the owner, a guy named Didier, and my wife spoke a little French, but I didn't speak any French. But I was learning while I was there, and I tried to ask him in my French, he didn't speak English, what was going on with the donkey and the goat. And what I thought he told me was the goat was the donkey's girlfriend. And I was like, from San Francisco, you know, I'm pretty open-minded, whatever. I'm not gonna say anything. And then we talked about it again in December of that year, and my French had greatly improved. I had 10 months more of time to learn it, the language. And he told me that my expression gave away for the fact that I had no idea what he was talking about. Mm. But what he had done is he had trained his donkey to eat around grapevines to provide weed control, just natural weed control. And he has a vineyard super steep that is impossible to use mechanical weed control. Like, you can't plow it. Right. There's not a migrant labor force you can hire. Like, a lot of our vineyards, we hand hoe. He doesn't have that opportunity. So he trained the donkey to do this, but the donkey was very, very stubborn. So he got it a goat as a companion animal, or a friend. And that's where I got mixed up. And it turns out it's actually relatively common. If you walk, since we're sitting here in Berkeley, if you go to the Golden Gate Fields and you walk through the stables, you'll see with horses, this was 5 or 6 years ago, but we walked through the stables, and I think we counted about 15 goats with horses out there, maybe probably 200 or 300 horses. They even out other animals' temperaments for some reason. So that's where the name came from.
So how does your wife's story vary?
Well, there's a second part of this story, which is occasionally I would be really, during harvest, the French crew that we worked with thought I was stubborn. So for example, if it was 11:45 and it was time for our hour-long lunch break and we had 30 more minutes work in the vineyard and we could be done for the day, I would choose to be a typical American and do the 30 more minutes work and then delay my lunch. That wasn't acceptable to the French workers. They thought I was very much an idiot, and they joked occasionally that Tracy was my goat because she would even out my temperament, which is also part of the story.
Yeah. You were stubborn like a donkey, and she was like the goat. So I kind of like that version.
The irony is, I think of between the two of us, she's the more stubborn person overall.
So, yeah, one doesn't have to necessarily relate to the other, does it?
No.
You could both be the donkey and the goat.
Exactly.
Well, if we have any wine nerds or science geeks out there listening who love details, your manifesto written by Tracy, your wife, is a deep explanation of how and why you craft your wine.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was started out as a letter to the former wine buyer of the Slanted Door restaurant in San Francisco about what we don't do. And he's long since moved on, and Slanted Door remained a really good customer. But she went through and explained why we do and why we don't do things. And we've left it up since then. And it's a funny thing. Like the New York Times gave a couple of years ago, they had 10 winemakers in America that were worth watching from an interesting standpoint. And one of the things that Eric mentioned in his little write-up about us was that, you know, who couldn't love a winery with a manifesto on its website? So
tell us about the wines that you do make. You focus on Rhone varieties, but you make a few others.
You know, when we came back from France, the guy we worked for, Eric Texier, lives in the Beaujolais, but he makes Rhone. And at the time we worked for him, he had some vineyard holdings in the southern end of Burgundy, where he made Chardonnay from. So when we came back, we made Chardonnay and Rhone varietals. And that's where we've mainly stayed focused. Actually, the second part of that component is when we came back, my wife made the Chardonnay, and then we made some of the other things together, and I made some of the bigger reds. And we've gone through this organic switch where I make the Chardonnays now, and she does some other projects. Over the course of time, we've added Pinot Gris from Anderson Valley. We're really interested in that. I make a tiny bit of Napa Valley Cabernet. Napa Valley is really interesting to me. I think it's got this incredible terroir, but it's actually really difficult to find people who will sell to a smaller winery like us and are organic. It's actually probably the hardest place to find organic grapes, at least in the appellations I work with. And then we experiment a little bit with other stuff. We're really fascinated by, particularly right now, any white grape that holds its acidity in California. That's probably our most interesting wines to make.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have a lot of press on your website. A lot of people are talking about you, so you're doing some good things, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
That's all?
That's all. I don't know what else to say to that. Enjoy some wine. Let's go to the tasting room and taste.
Oh, all right.
The easygoing Jared Brandt of Donkey and Goat Winery. Their urban tasting room is a nice wide-open space in Berkeley and well worth the visit to try one of the modern pioneers in natural wine and pet nat. You can find his other esoteric wines at donkeyandgoat.com. If you're listening to this on iTunes, Stitcher, or another podcast provider, you can find more interviews and interesting content on my website, onthewineroad.com. I'm on Facebook as On the Wine Road and Instagram and Twitter at JDWineRoad. If you'd like to join my wine community, look for me on Patreon. There I provide compelling tidbits you won't find elsewhere, and I give you tempting incentives as a patron. That's patreon.com/onthewineroad. Patreon is Patreon. Thank you for your continued support and keeping me company on the wine road.